Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, our show will air a live interview of Cheryl Ferguson by host Patricia Bartholomew. On December 3, 2019, Kansas City police shot and killed 26-year-old Cameron Lamb, a black male, in his own backyard. Cheryl Ferguson will talk about Cameron Lamb. He was a friend to her family and loved by his family. There has been a lack of answers about what happened the night Cameron Lamb was shot and killed by three plainclothes police officers in Kansas City. Cheryl Ferguson knew Cameron Lamb and his family for years. She's familiar with the police department, having been given a police certificate of appreciation in 2016 for her work in the community. She used her public comment time during the January's Police Commission meeting to the full, and she'll talk with us about her message. Nationwide, police killed 1,099 people in 2019. Of those, 24% were black, a number disproportionate to the total numbers of black people in our country. In 2019, there were two such deaths by Kansas City police officers and one by a Clay County Sheriff's deputy. Ferguson still has questions and favors local control of the police, believing that might be a better route to effective police policy. Stay tuned. Jaws of Justice wants our listeners to know we appreciate each and every one of you. A crisis on the scale of the pandemic can reorder society in dramatic ways, for better or worse. All of society pays a heavy price for decades of failing to create a rational system of health care that works for all of us. Please take care. We will air the 420 drug war news at the end of our program. Let's listen now to Pat Bartholomew and Cheryl Ferguson.
Good morning. This is Pat Bartholomew. This morning, we're talking about an unfortunately all too familiar sequence of events. An African American is shot by the Kansas City Police Department with no probable cause, and the police and the prosecuting attorney see no need for further investigation, returning personnel involved in this situation to duty very soon after this incident happened in December of 2019. This is the story of Cameron Lamb talking to, hopefully, Cheryl Ferguson.
I am here, Pat. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. We're on the air, Cheryl. And I'm going to ask you to jump in and talk about Cameron Lamb. Who was he? Why is this such a terrible difficult time for his family, and who is going to be the father to his three children?
That is so much a great question. When I actually gave back the award to the police commissioner's meeting in January, I actually posed that same question. Cameron had a middle son, Sincere, that actually had asked the question right around before the funeral, how long will my dad be dead? So, yeah, that's a great question of who's going to be the father now. But Cameron had three sons, Cameron, Cameron, and Sincere. Actually, Sincere is the middle child. And Sincere was being raised by Cameron. So Cameron was a father that was really taking care of his own. He was a mechanic that just loved to tinker with things. He would love to figure out ways to work on cars, and he hated to be stumped, so he'd always have a network of people he could call to get help to make sure that he could get that car repair completed successfully. And in that, he just was so loving. There was a story that I found out after his passing that there was two women that were stuck on the highway, had been waiting 2 hours for their family to show up, and here comes Cameron with three boys in the car, told his kids to be calm and be good, which they did the entire time. The woman actually let us know that Cameron took them to where they needed to go when he couldn't fix the car on the side of the road, and then to help them avoid getting the car impounded, went back the next day and towed. And she actually said that we can't pay you. He said that's fine. So she did everything she could to recommend people to him for car repairs after that, just because that's the giving person he was.
Yes, exactly. Let's, since we're a little late in starting, let's talk about what happened on December 3rd, 2019. Can you kind of shape what happened that day for our listeners?
Yeah, I can shape it differently than the police narrative has given out. So basically what started in, and I've said from the beginning, we're not professing that Cameron was a saint. He actually had had an argument with his girlfriend on that day. When she took off, he took off after. And that's what started the helicopter presence, which we have no idea why the helicopters were already surveying the east side. I hear after the fact it's done frequently. But the helicopters were actually navigating his travel. So, yes, he was speeding through residential streets. Yes, he did potentially run a red light. I don't have anything that proves that other than the narrative. But when he got close to home, he left that whole situation. So the problem was gone. He went home. He pulled in, backed into his driveway, backed into his garage, which is not something you can do at a I'm-trying-to-run-and-hide type scenario. So after he had got into his property, then police show up undercover, and they already approached the front of the house with guns drawn. They went around to the back after the homeowner had let them know, I guess, where Cameron was. I'm not really sure how that transpired. But then a few minutes later, Cameron was no more. And in that, I don't necessarily know he was no more because they kept the ambulance from coming onto the scene to even treat him for at least 45 minutes. There was a man who said that Cameron lit his cigarette for him as he was coming home. And the man said his cigarette was still burning by the time that they had shot and killed him.
So is it fair to say that Cameron didn't really pose a risk to the police? Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
Not at all. I mean, by the time they showed up, he was in his own, minding his own business.
And as I understand it, he did have a gun, but he had a license to carry the weapon?
That is correct. So Cameron was not a felon. He definitely did legally own his firearm. The thing that I have a problem with in the narrative that the police have given is that Cameron was right-handed. He actually had a piece of his index finger missing from his left hand. So not only was he not predominant in his left hand, but he also had an injury that would not have necessarily made that a hand that you would have pointed a weapon in to shoot at someone that, to me, was already posing a threat to you because they came at him with guns already drawn.
And you had mentioned to me that after this happened, and I presume Cameron was taken away in an ambulance, that the family was not contacted about what had happened for approximately 8 hours.
That is correct. They already knew what happened. After the initial shooting, there's other family members that live on the block. One of the sisters was actually down by the house, which she was brought in for questioning. She had nothing to do with what happened. So the network of people in the community had already let it be known to the family what had happened, but the police didn't show up until 8:30. And from the information that I got from a phone call after my January meeting with the police commissioners, they actually were delayed because they didn't have a black minister available.
Which, as you pointed out to me, really was not an issue with this family. That they didn't come and talk to the family.
It shouldn't be an issue with anyone. I mean, when it comes to the nature of losing someone's life, or even if they hadn't killed Cameron and Cameron was in the hospital, we could care less if they're green, black, purple, gray, or tan. Tell us.
Right,
exactly. Be upfront, be honest.
You had mentioned to me that you thought that one of the things that was going on that day was that there, in fact, was another situation that the police were really following, and that you had suggested that this might have been a case of mistaken identity. Do you remember talking about that? There was something else. There was another case that they were actually involved with. And it's apparent from the recording that was made with the police that there was another reason that they were up in the air that really didn't have anything to do with Cameron. They actually
the very next day arrested a man that was about 20 years Cameron Sr. With very short dreadlocks, similar to the type that Cameron had, beard kind of grown in, similar to the way that Cameron's beard was grown in. And it just has to lead you to question, with all of that action and Cameron not being a violent person, If you actually got to know him, I actually have made comments in the past that had the police actually done community policing, which was the efforts that I was talking about in 2016 when I got the award, had they done community policing, they would have probably been Cameron's friend. Cameron would have probably helped to work on their cars. They would have had a different type of relationship.
Right.
So I don't think that they would have taken that action had they known Cameron. I really don't think that that's who they were intending on being in the home when they shot and killed him.
And actually, you were saying his family wasn't in the house. They weren't actually his immediate family. Is that my understanding? That's the reason they weren't on the property with Cameron.
That's correct. They weren't there at the time that it happened.
Okay. Well, and so basically, what happened after this? There was an investigation by the police, and as I understand it, possibly the prosecuting attorney. What happened after this case? That was in December 3rd. That was December 3rd. What happened after that?
Well, December 3rd, Cameron was killed. December 12th, the officer that shot and killed him was already back on the force. That's by the own admission of Chief of Police, Chief Smith. And I actually questioned him about that in February's meeting, or actually, I'm sorry, March's meeting. To me, I don't think mentally that I would trust an officer that feels comfortable going back on live duty 9 days after killing someone.
And so was this also investigated by the prosecuting attorney as well?
They still have the case at this time, and they really haven't done any further action. So there's always that. You know, we hear in the laws that a criminal has a right to a speedy trial, but when the criminal potentially is the police, it's always drawn out long, long time. Ryan Stokes' case is 7 years old and still hasn't been finalized.
Right. And so basically, there was clearly some public reaction to this. I don't know if it was in December. The interesting thing is there's still press on the case now. As late as March, they were still talking about this case. So someone was keeping the case alive. I think that's pretty amazing that the public is still following the case. There's still press being, you know, talked about that the case is still live.
Absolutely. The March incident that you're speaking of, actually Gwen Grant with the Urban League had a two-week, two-part session, killed by the police, that could happen to you. In the first meeting, they actually had both Cameron and Ryan Stokes' family's attorneys there to speak a little bit about the case and give some background information. The following week, there were a few attorneys from the Board of Attorneys that basically were just having a panel to help us know our rights, knowing the Office of Citizens Complaints. But in that action with that first week on March 5th, yes, the press was in attendance. And yes, the family is like, when I go to the police commissioner's meeting, I've not gone alone at all. The only time that I was alone was in COVID-19 in April, but every other time that I've been there, the family's there with me. They do not want this to be quiet. They definitely want community input to make sure that we know where there's certain things that we want. For example, body cams. And just in the meeting from April, they've actually, Chief Smith has said that it's not an important factor. He did not include it in the budget. And that was in the midst of two of the commissioners speaking up that saying, well, the community wants it, so it needs to happen.
Yes, that's interesting. I didn't realize that they did not have body cams yet. So that is still an issue that hasn't been solved by the police department. Or the board of police commissioners.
Yeah, the commissioners do, but the chief doesn't. So that's kind of why the local control is still an argument of what needs to happen, of the dynamic of how the police forces ran.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that was still an issue that really hadn't been settled in this community, that the police were not wearing body cams. That's
not a requirement. I don't even know if officers have to put them on. There might be a handful that have them, but for the most part, they're speaking of technical issues and wanting to make sure that they technically work. But if all of these other you know, cities throughout the country can make it technically work. I don't see where it should be that hard.
Yeah, that's interesting. Given all the fact that, you know, this, it almost seems like there's, they've got at least 2 to 3 years worth of evidence of the fact that body cams really are necessary, because the public wants to know what happens at incidences that involve police shootings.
And truthfully, it's also a protection to them as well.
Absolutely.
So if they're doing a good shoot, which I hate that term, that's a hunting term, but that's what they call it. If they do a good shoot, you should want proof that you did everything right.
Yeah, that's a terrible expression. I had never heard that until you said that on the phone the other day. A good shoot is described as successful shoot. I mean, what does that mean exactly?
They'll use it in terminology of a good shoot, meaning that they were justified in pulling the trigger, that the actions taken were the right cause to take in that kind of effort. The meeting from March 12th with the kill by the police that could happen to you, one of the things one of the attorneys brought up is that a lot of times you can look at the actions that take place at any incident. Most times the officer that shoots to kill is not the only one there. So there was an incident that happened with the FBI and the police involved, I believe it was in February, that all officers had drawn their guns. All officers had fired. And she said when something of that nature happens, you know that that's the actual proper steps to take because everyone did it. But when we have Ryan Stokes, when we have Terrence Bridges, when we have Cameron Lamb, only one officer shot, kind of makes you wonder, why is it only that one officer felt the need to use deadly force?
So clearly there was a difference in police narratives between what the public was given as information about this killing and actually what the police narrative was that was put out almost immediately.
Absolutely. They gave a narrative up until the point that they would seem like they had done anything wrong. And I've questioned them about that. You're saying that you can't talk about it, but yet and still you have a narrative up until. You don't really talk about, you know, what happened once they arrived at the house. That narrative is not published at all. But they give the narrative of Cameron's driving, which basically is going to paint him in a bad picture. But if by the time you killed him, he was in his home and he was a traffic threat, since when do undercovers show up for a traffic violation?
Right. In other words, there was no probable cause for them to be on the property, which seems to be part of the case that is being filed, which we'll talk about after the break. There was no real reason for them to be on the property, to have their guns drawn. And as an expert on police chases was saying that, you know, there's a police chase, there's an appropriateness for a police chase if there's a probable cause for a crime. There's been a murder, there's been a rape, there's been a bank robbery. There's got to be some reason that the police are chasing someone. That's an ongoing issue that's being looked at by a lot of people as the, particularly given the dangerousness that we know of police chases.
Right, and it's April 20th, and there still hasn't been a probable cause statement released. So we're, 5 months later?
Right. Yeah, so I think, though, that it's, you know, the idea, one of the things that Lee Merritt, the attorney, and we'll talk more about Lee Merritt with this case, who's a nationally known civil rights lawyer, is that there's always this issue of starting a narrative that basically makes the victim look bad, and so that they can justify, you know, that they were in fact being there was a risk to the police officers when in fact they were really the ones who, you know, presented the risk. They were the ones who basically set up the hazard. And so that to me is kind of interesting, that it's almost nationally accepted that the first thing the police will do is make the victim look bad.
All the time. I've actually jokingly spoken with a few people that I know that kind of know the law, and it's hard to do because of the right to free speech, but there is a narrative that is always given about the black community, even for the case that Lee Merritt is more popularly known for, and that's the Amber Geiger case. When Jean Botham was killed in his own home eating ice cream, they had to bring up the fact that he had marijuana in his system. the Atiana Jefferson, when she was killed in her own home, shot through the window. They brought up the fact she had a gun in her home. Well, who doesn't?
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's great to know that there are people that are really looking at the issues that clearly are used to justify police killings. And what I recently did was looked up the FBI in the Uniform Crime Report to see how many police killings there were just last year. And they were 1,099 killings by police officers in the United States. And of course, you know, the police call them justified homicides. And the interesting part about that is Missouri and Kansas does not track police shootings. So the Kansas City Star tracks the police killings, but not, you know, the state, you know, the law enforcement agencies in both Missouri and Kansas.
That leaves a big question of why.
Well, it does. And I think it's people like you that want to keep these issues alive. It's, you know, that's what it takes. It takes social action. It takes the public coming together and saying, you know, this has got to stop. And so, you know, it's clearly become a kind of an epidemic in the country. Police shootings.
Too often. And again, the narrative actually also taints to where it helps to continue to spread the fear. So for some reason, there seems to be a thought that melanin is a weapon, and melanin is the thing that makes our skin dark. So for some reason, it's just commonly talked about that it's just to hear the narrative of a black man with a gun, automatically it feels like if they say that they feel like the shooting is justified.
Right.
So like Philando Castile, when he was a licensed concealed and carry, and he let the officer know, this is what I have. And the officer asked him to make motion and then shot and killed him when he did.
Right. You're talking about the case in Minnesota where
correct.
A young man was shot in his car and it was filmed by his friend that was in the car. That, of course, went international. It went viral, as they say, because it was pretty outlandish. That police officer actually was charged with manslaughter, and then the case was dismissed later. So that was a particularly egregious situation. As I understand, that's when your 30-day vigil 3 years ago started at the police station. Was over
that's
the Philando Castile case.
That one, and then right before him was Alton Sterling. So, yes, it was just kind of something that actually was started by Kevin Roberson. And I really only showed up the first day that he did it to bring them water, and somehow I ended up joining forces with him and then Ty Fu Panda, which they're both comedians. But so Ty is his stage name, but the only name he's known by. But yeah, it was kind of like, we have to stop it. And a few days in, I was like, well, maybe instead of trying to make them seem as the enemy, I said, well, maybe we can work on embracing them and becoming friends with them, because if they're your friend, they won't kill you. So I actually started a photog starting day 5 of our protest. And that's kind of what led up to the award, because when it ended, I felt such a good momentum that I wanted to celebrate it. And once I posed that, Captain Mills of East Patrol at that time, he's now a major.
Cheryl, we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back after a break and continue our discussion.
Now the calendar for the week of April 20. In compliance with the local instruction, all live meetings are suspended until the all clear is given by the mayor. All Quarries Network activities, meetings, vigils, and fundraisers have been canceled. When they resume normal activities, we will pass them on to you. The mission of Quarries Network is to provide immediate services to families surviving homicide. See Quarries Network on Facebook or their website, quarriesnetwork.org. Monday, April 20 at 7 p.m., the Kansas City virtual meeting of Moms Demand Action Missouri will be meeting virtually using the Zoom online platform. More information at act.everytown.org. April Kansas Issues to Action meeting hosted by Moore Square will be April 20 at 6:30 p.m. via Zoom. Go to Moore Square on Facebook for more information. Although KC Mothers in Charge is not able to gather together in person this year, they ask we remember all the lives impacted by violence and crime in Kansas City. For hashtag National Crime Victims Rights Week, every day this week, they will share a post in remembrance of a victim of violence. You can join them to honor victims of violence by sharing posts. For more information, find them on the web at www.kcmothersincharge.org or KC Mothers in Charge on Facebook. Considering COVID-19, the Midwest Innocence Project's 2020 Faces of Innocence Gala will be postponed to a later date. Safety is the paramount concern. All tickets and sponsorships will be honored for the new date, which has yet to be determined. If you have already purchased a ticket or sponsorship for the program, you will be contacted. The Willow Domestic Violence 24-hour hotline is 785-843-3333. Thursday, April 23rd, is Smart Justice Virtual Meeting, 6 p.m. for Douglas County, Kansas, and 7:15 p.m. for Johnson County. The ACLU of Kansas is still committed to doing the work and protecting our most vulnerable populations, including those incarcerated. You can join the ACLU of Kansas Smart Justice Campaign with their first series of virtual Smart Justice Strategy meetings. Be sure to RSVP for the meeting so they can send a Zoom meeting invitation. More information at Douglas County ACLU Smart Justice on Facebook. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. Please take care of yourselves and others. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank all our volunteers. Please listen next week.
We are back on air. This is Jaws of Justice, and we're talking to Cheryl Ferguson this morning. Cheryl, you're still with us?
I am.
Okay, good. We are going to continue our discussion of what we call an unfortunately too familiar sequence of events. African-American man shot by the Kansas City Police Department, clearly with no probable cause. And what happened after that, with the police and prosecuting attorney seeing no need for further investigation and returning personnel that are involved in the situation to duty. So Cheryl is passionate in keeping this subject alive. And Cheryl, I think what we want to do is go and start talking a little bit about the public support of this. Gwen Grant got involved in this situation. She was quoted in an opinion editorial by the Kansas City Star talking about, again, the fact that there was no probable cause. And in fact, started, as we touched on, but I think I want to go back and touch on that again, the issue of she started a series of forums on called Killing by the Police, It Could Happen to You. Can you talk a little bit of what happened there?
Yes. So on the first evening, which was on March 5th, Lee Merritt and Cindy, and I can't think of her last name.
Cindy Short, I believe.
Yes. So those are the two attorneys representing the two cases that they were discussing that evening, and that would be the case of Cameron Lamb and Ryan Stokes. And just kind of going over the narrative, like with, for example, Ryan's case, one of the things that Cindy mentioned was that the officers basically were questioned after Ryan's killing for about 10 minutes, but the friends of Ryan that were there present were, at no better way to describe, but interrogated for 3 hours. And they had done nothing but just be there. So it just seems questionable that there's so little that's required of the police when something of that nature happens. And then Lee kind of touched on the facts of with the way that Cameron was killed, he was actually killed in his home. So it was more than a violation of his Second Amendment rights, It was also his Fourth Amendment right.
Right. To be honest with you,
to be secure in your own dwelling.
I think I thought that was very interesting. I knew kind of just enough about the Fourth Amendment to not talk about it at length, but I went back and kind of looked at what does it really cover? And it's clearly a big part of a case that we'll get to shortly is the fact that this man's Fourth Amendment rights were violated. And in fact, this is going to be part of a case that's been filed in federal courts on the Cameron Lamb case. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I don't really have that much to necessarily be intelligent in my conversation, but in that, just at the aspect that Cameron was in his own home, Missouri is a stand your ground state. The officers were undercover, so that does mean that they would not have been easily identifiable, with the blues that we normally would see our officers in. So we don't know what presented when they came back in the back. We don't know how clear it was, the danger. Truthfully, I don't even really know that we can tell for certain that Cameron actually had even pointed that gun. Like I mentioned, he was right-handed. So how is it that he has a gun found on the ground on his left-hand side? Why is it that they did not allow the ambulance to immediately come in and you know, determine whether or not he could have been saved? He was not shot in his head. He was shot in his chest, his arm, and his hand.
Yeah, well, we have, unfortunately, we have that terrible picture of Michael Brown laying on the ground in Ferguson for clearly hours.
I think it was four. It might have been longer.
Before the police were actually allowing an ambulance to come and basically see if the man could have been revived. So I don't even know how to justify the police's action in that.
They are not giving
emergency aid to who's clearly a victim.
You know, the funny thing about that is that, and I've kind of been trying to be protective over Cameron's mother as much as I can. So when I hear news, I try and cushion the blow. Like, for example, when the judge determined to give immunity. For the officer that killed Ryan Stokes. I was actually in Jefferson City with the ACLU on that day. And just when I heard the news, I was like, okay, I have to call her before she sees it, because everything of that nature is going to be a trigger for her. It makes her almost relive the events of December 3rd over and over again. So not long after we started going to the police commissioners, they killed almost back-to-back two people that they made sure that the media, and this again goes to the media only reports what the police tell them. So they had two incidents that they killed someone, but they made sure that they announced all of the efforts that they did. They used beanbags first. They, after they determined that they couldn't do anything else and they shot them, they did try and provide medical attention. And, you know, actually in those, Cameron's mom saw the story before I did. And she was like, well, why is it that they're doing it so big to make sure that you took that extra effort, and why didn't you do it for my son?
Right. It's interesting. Did Lee Merritt become part of this case? And Lee Merritt is a nationally recognized civil rights attorney. And did he become involved in this case after the Urban League forum? Or was
No.
that was it before?
Before Cameron was even buried, Lee Merritt was on board. So Lee actually called for a second autopsy to be done. We wanted to make sure that everything was evaluated. So Cameron didn't have any gun residue on his hands. Therefore, we know he never fired a gun.
Oh, that's good news.
So Lee Merritt has been there from the beginning.
Well, that's I had never heard that before. I don't think you and I discussed that. He clearly, and in fact, in what I read about what Lee Merritt was presenting as his defense, first of all, he makes this very interesting statement about, in fact, that he's doing this for three black fathers. He's involved in three black fathers' cases in federal court that have all been shot by the police. But he was saying, if I can quote the man, that he was particularly offended by the fact that Cameron Lamb was shot in his yard, in his own yard. He said, "I find that a particularly egregious breach of the rights of people that, you know, is in a state, as you say, has a stand your ground law that we can the police can kill people in their own house, in their own yard."
I mean, in that he very, very adamantly, you know, just brought up the fact that you should be able to feel safe in your home, where you lay your head. You actually are in your most vulnerable state when you're at home because you relax your guard. So that is something that he's been very adamant about, of pushing that we should be able to feel safe in our own homes, not fearful of the police, you know, Rambo coming in and killing us.
Right. He's, I thought that, and actually I was first, when I first heard about this situation, I was told mistakenly that the case had already been heard and been dismissed. That's obviously not true.
That's correct. So Jean Peters Baker still actually has the case at this time. And it is something that we're working patiently. Lee actually gave her very high accolades when he was here for the forum on March 5th, that of any prosecuting attorney that he has worked with, that she was the most willing to interact from anyone that he's worked with. So in that, he kind of gave positive hopes. But the only thing that I say is that when I look at the track record of the interaction, I hope that hope is not falsely felt.
You're obviously an authority in this case. You're saying that the prosecuting attorney's office has to make a decision before it can move forward in the federal court?
Yes. She makes the determination of whether or not to go to grand jury. She makes the determination of whether or not any charges are going to be filed, because the police have basically said it's a good shoot and they're not doing anything themselves.
And so in order to advance it to the federal court, it has to. There has to be a determination of guilt on the part of the officers before it becomes a civil suit. Am I saying that correctly?
I'm not 100% certain as far as how that works. As far as the guilt with the officers, it could be even just with the policies and procedures of the department as well. I know one thing that Lee did make clear is that whenever you get to the point of actually going into that courtroom, the judge is not even the most powerful person in that room. He said it's the prosecuting attorney. So what the prosecuting attorney presents sways the entire rest of the case.
That's really interesting. I think that there's so much to be learned from these situations. I think you make a really valid point that what we're really not trying to do here is to basically say that the police acted in a way that was irresponsible. I guess that's what you're saying when we're looking at policies and procedures. In other words, we're not blaming a policeman. We're saying what happens that this kind of situation occurs. I think that's what you're trying to do in your work, establishing a relationship and rapport with the police department.
And the fact that I question, you know, Chief Smith, I don't think that there should be a mental capability for someone to go back to work so quickly after killing someone. And if you are mentally capable to go back to work after killing someone, I don't want you on my police force.
Right. That's a good point. You mentioned something, too, about the black community feeling victimized by the questioning they're subjected to during these incidences. We're little bit out of sequence, but I wanted to go back and touch on that. What happens during these situations?
Well, it's a whole trauma that does take place, to where even though you are completely innocent, you're still made to feel guilty. You're still treated like a criminal. You're still questioned. You're still basically not arrested, but still put in a situation to where you feel vulnerable.
And you're talking about people that are what we would say are innocent bystanders. They could be
Correct. People
on the scene, or I believe you mentioned that Cameron Lamb's sister was questioned at length.
Yes, and she wasn't even present at the time that it happened, so why would you even be asking her anything? She showed up after the fact. There shouldn't have been any engagement with somebody that was not even present at the time.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. I think we obviously understand that police have investigative work to do in any situation. But again, it almost sounds like what you're saying is that they were starting a criminal investigation of Cameron Lamb, you know, which is sort of was all pretty premature at the time that this man was shot.
It happens every single time a black man is. If you just go through the history of any single case that has ever been presented that there's been a black man killed by anyone in law enforcement, on or off duty, you will find an angle to say that he's not good, he's done something. So with Cameron, they actually really couldn't find anything. That's why they left it with just the narrative that he was a black man with a gun. But because of the stigmata that we already have in this society, hearing a black man with a gun automatically makes him guilty.
Right. And that's interesting. I want to just restate that for our listeners, that there was no residue found on his hand, so he had not fired a gun.
That is correct.
I think that's an important piece. You know, one of the things I wanted to do before we finished our show, Cheryl, was give you an opportunity to talk about how you plan on keeping this issue alive for the public. You had talked about some of the activities, some of the events that you were planning on putting together. I want to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know what's going to be planned in the community and give them information on how to get hold of you. How, in fact, to, you know, if they're interested in getting more information about what you're planning.
Certainly. I've actually established a page, and I kind of did it so that everyone had a chance that loved Cameron to interact with each other, to share. So there is a Facebook page, hashtag justice, the number 4 CD. So that's the hashtag, and then JUSTICE. Numeral 4, and then just CD, which Cameron Darnell Lamb was his name, so CD is what everyone called him.
Okay.
But his birthday is in June, so God willing, we're out of COVID restrictions by then.
Right.
And I'm working on trying to put together, now I'm rushing because it's kind of COVID kind of put me in a stall. I don't know what to do, but it's like I've got to push forward. So working on putting together a Cameron's Day of Service. Like I talked about the incident with the ladies on the highway that Cameron helped. That's what he loved to do. He loved to fix cars. So I'm hoping that I can get some mechanics that would volunteer their services. I've been working with the ACLU. So we definitely will work on trying to protect those, you know, mechanics that they can't come back for any faulty work,
right.
But, you know, just basic services. And, you know, just celebrate his birth, celebrate his life, and help to make this hopefully an annual event. That people that might not be able to afford their car repairs, so they can come get their brakes or their oil changed, you know, at no extra cost other than the cost of the materials that are needed.
Well,
so we're planning that June 13th.
Okay. And you will be putting out information on where this is going to be held, and then, in fact, the public is invited to attend.
Absolutely.
You'll be putting that out in your Facebook. Am I saying that correctly? Facebook
page? Yes, on the Justice for CD page.
Okay, that's good. Well, you know, incidentally, just to let you know, I actually have a friend who died, and it's interesting that you're doing this because they also had a day of service where people could come at a church where he was a member and have their oil changed.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, I thought that was very, very intriguing. What was really interesting is that the church did it where his services were. You know, the minister said, you know, George would be great for this, would be grateful for this opportunity. But he said, George would tell you to change your oil. So it doesn't sound as far-fetched as people may think, that it's, in fact, it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a great way to give back to the community. And I think Cameron would be delighted with this. You know, and the other thing I want to touch on before we finish is the idea, since you have been such a stalwart presence at police board of commissioner meetings, they are open to the public. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. They're normally held on the second Tuesday of each month. The Dates sometimes do change. And like even with COVID, we ended up doing it virtually this month. So they did a Facebook Live, but you could submit emails beforehand, which I actually encourage people to do. Their email address is bopc@kcpd.org. So that's Board of Police Commissioners at Kansas City Police Department. And I mean, I encourage people to start emailing them. I plan on trying to start an email campaign to ask them, or not ask, but demand that we demand that they put it at the forefront that we need body cam. You need it to protect you, but we really in the black community need it to protect us. They have killed 5 black people since, including Cameron's death, but they killed 5 black people since December 3rd.
You know, oh, they have. Okay, well, yeah. That's, I did not know that piece of information. The other thing you talked about very briefly, and we have 1 minute left, I'm told,
okay.
And so I want to just remind you that you had talked about the possibility of having an independent investigative citizens review board, which I think is absolutely a great idea that you evidently have been presenting to the Police Board of Commissioners.
Well, with the talk about the local control and the investigation that the City Council is doing now, it's a very hot topic. But that's what we expect to have it look like once this, whatever the city determines, whatever the police determine, we expect to be at the table. It can no longer be the police, police, and the police. We as citizens have a right to be part of the process to make sure that they're policing okay. Our communities the way that we should be policed.
Thank you, Cheryl. And thank you for being on the air with us. This has been Jaws of Justice, and we appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Earlier this month, drug reform pioneer Nicholas Eiley passed away. He was instrumental in a lot of folks deciding to take up this banner and carry it forward. Here's part of a discussion I had with him back in 2004.
This and said, you know, we have schools closing. We have busing issues. We need job training. We need after school programs. We need all sorts of things. There's no money for any of that. But come time to arrest people, well, all of a sudden there's millions of dollars around to arrest everybody that's committed a crime. And this is the first time that a city has said, hey, we need to look at this because we can't afford this.
Nicholas Eiley was talking about his home turf of Syracuse, New York, where he was the one rattling the cage and getting this done.
The homicide rate is skyrocketing in this town. Crime is increasing. And the only remedy seems to be reactive. We'll go and arrest people when they commit a crime. There's nothing spent on anything preventative.
I listened to some of the congressional investigations, went on, I think, a week and a half ago. And basically, they were saying that, yes, their policy does support Osama bin Laden, but let's just, you know, throw more money into it. You know, the $3 heroin on the East Coast, I understand. Osama bin Laden still making millions, and yet they want to, do everything they can to subsidize his effort.
Right. No, what's interesting, they always say it's drug profits that are funding terrorism. But I don't think there's money from Merck or from Sandoz or Bayer or any of that drug money that's going into funding Al-Qaeda. I think it's illegal drug money. In other words, money generated by the black market, by prohibition, that's funding those people.
We're going to close out this segment on Nicholas Eiley with the words of his son, Max. Quote, the work my father did in the field of drug policy was some of his proudest, and it remained the subject that he spoke most passionately about for the rest of his life. The idea that people continue to be incarcerated for voluntarily putting a substance into their bodies always struck him as the height of absurdity. If my dad had a single mantra, it would be, prohibition doesn't work. Thank you, Nicholas Eiley. Hopefully some of you will remember Nicholas Eiley through his online and printed material under the banner of Reconsider.
What will it take to motivate? Please visit drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now?
Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.